Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. My co-host, Meghna Chakrabarty, is out today. A quick correction. A moment ago, we reported on the memorial tomorrow at MIT for Officer Sean Collier that will be attended by Vice President Joe Biden. That memorial is not open to the public. It is open to the MIT community. And now, moving on, the legal case has begun. Somehow the chaos is behind us. The bombings, the terror, the police chase, the shootouts are in the history books. One suspect is dead. Another lies wounded in a Boston hospital. And that's where the legal case against 19-year-old Shahar Tsarnaev began yesterday. A judge magistrate read him his rights. According to a court transcript, Tsarnaev was alert enough to respond by nodding his head. At one point, even mouthing the word no when asked if he could afford his own attorney. Then he was indicted for using a weapon of mass destruction that killed three people and destroyed public property. And so a new story about American due process and the trial of the Boston Marathon bomber begins. Listeners, what's your question about this extraordinary case? Does it make sense to you that Tsarnaev will be tried through the civilian system of justice? Is it clear to you why he wasn't indicted as a terrorist? How does he get a fair trial in the wake of such a shocking and public act of terror? What other questions do you have? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. We have two great legal minds with us right now to answer some questions, including yours. Joining us by phone is Nancy Gertner. She's a former U.S. federal judge for Massachusetts and is now on the Harvard Law School faculty. And Judge Gertner, welcome back to Radio Boston. It's great to have you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Also with us, Alan Dershowitz. He's the Felix Frankfurter Professor of Law at Harvard. He's also defended some very high-profile defendants over the years. Professor Dershowitz, great to have you.
Pleasure to be on, especially a pleasure to be on with my friend Nancy.
Well, let's start with the big question. I just like to know, and I'll start with you, Judge Gertner, even though this is a great question for a defense attorney as well, but how does this young man get a fair trial?
That's going to be an interesting question. I think that the first question for the defense lawyers as they get closer to trial would be, can there be a fair trial in Massachusetts? Now, it's very difficult in these days of saturated media publicity to get a change of venue because media is everywhere. There is an argument, particularly given the response of Boston, that the victim here were not only the people who were harmed or maimed, it was the city. Certainly that's the way it has been experienced. And so that actually could be a basis for the trial to be moved to another location. You'll recall that Timothy McVeigh was tried in Colorado. It doesn't happen every day, but certainly that would be an argument.
Alan Dershowitz, you're agreeing with that.
I agree with it, except that the defense lawyer is going to have to make a tough tactical decision. He may or she may actually decide that a Boston jury is less likely to impose the death penalty than a Springfield jury or a jury in some other town. Boston, after all, is the capital of a state that has abolished the death penalty. So if the trial is going to be about the merits, guilt or innocence, then you really want to try a change of venue, perhaps. If the trial is only going to be about does he get the death penalty or does he get life imprisonment, it's not a self-evident proposition that the defendant will necessarily choose to move the case to a different place. I think this is not going to be a trial about the facts. The facts seem easily provable through the videos, and because they chose not to indict him as a terrorist, but rather as an ordinary murderer using weapons of mass destruction, no intentional element, no intent to intimidate, to coerce, has to be proved. And so we may see two kinds of defenses, either a jihad defense. I did it. I'm happy. I'm proud. I want to die. I want to join my brother. I want to be a martyr. I don't think we're going to hear that based on what we've heard from answers from the question. Well, the other is my brother did it. He pushed me, forced me. That doesn't make me innocent, but it makes me less culpable, and maybe I shouldn't get the death penalty. I suspect that's what we're going to see.
I agree with Alan that this is a tactical decision, and they would want to know, you don't want to wind up in a rural area with more punitive attitudes than in Boston, mm-hmm. but certainly it would be available to make that argument.
That's right.
Alan Dershowitz, I want to come back to you and sort of ask you to sort of be the defense lawyer here. You just laid out two possible routes, the sort of jihad defense. Right. I did it. I'm proud of it. And, you know, put me to death and I'll go to heaven with the other martyrs, or this cooperating and trying to avoid the death penalty. What do you advise him as a defense attorney to do? I mean, what's the sort of first conversation you have with him?
It's not the role of the defense attorney to become part of a jihad defense. You don't need a lawyer for that. In fact, most people who make those defenses represent themselves because they don't want a lawyer interfering with their martyrdom. They want to be executed. My recommendation is based first on what the defendant tells me. You have to assess what the facts are. Does he have information that he hasn't yet revealed about his brother's connections when he went back to Russia, about what kind of websites they had access to? Does he have anything worth trading for his life, or does it have to be a purely sympathetic defense? The sympathy is going to be a very hard sell. Even though he's 19 and he has a kind of innocent face and a good record in high school, when they show the videotape of him in a cold-blooded way, just putting the bag down in front of children, knowing that these children are going to be injured or killed, it's going to be very hard to get sympathy from a jury.
And Nancy Gertner, I'm curious, too. I mean, let's say there's a case that, you know, to spare his life, he's going to cooperate, let's say, with federal investigators. We're already reading that Zhahar Tsarnaev has told interrogators that the American wars in Iraq and Afghanistan motivated him and his brother, and that investigators at this point believe pretty certainly that there's no evidence that he received instructions that led to an attack or that he was part of any other network, all of which gets to this point. He's got nothing to trade in an effort to spare his life.
Well, I mean, I think that the question that they must have been asking in the hospital room would be, where did he get the bomb making materials from? I mean, it may be that that's going to be online, but certainly the authorities will want to have some basis to understand how someone, even without foreign help, could possibly have done what he did. They want to know who else knew about it, whether or not in other words, it's not necessarily an outsider, insider, foreign, domestic issue. There could be something to trade, whether or not they would be willing to trade for suppliers or co-conspirators that are not, you know, highly placed in exchange for the death penalty is an open question.
Sure.
And remember, too, that the decision has not yet been formally made to seek the death penalty. And so the first job a lawyer has is not to appeal to the jury, but to actually seek a meeting with the Attorney General of the United States and his staff to try to persuade them not to seek the death penalty. There's a whole formal process that has to be gone through under rules of the Justice Department before the Attorney General makes the decision to seek the death penalty. It'll be a hard sell, but a lawyer, if he's asked by his client to do that, has to try to get the Attorney General first not to seek the death penalty.
And in fact, the first thing that the lawyers did in this case is to seek, quote, learned counsel, which are counsel that are schooled in death penalty defense. So even though the death penalty hasn't been sought, the legal team is already seeking to include, as they would have to if there was an actual death penalty sought, but they're seeking to include lawyers who are schooled in death penalty defense, and they have to go outside of Massachusetts for the most part because very few lawyers within Massachusetts have experience with a death penalty case.
By the way, I think that's a mistake.
Oh, really?
My own view is that they shouldn't be seeking mediocre lawyers with death penalty experience if they can instead get first-rate Boston lawyers without death penalty experience. That death penalty experience is somewhat valuable, but there are a lot of mediocre people who do death penalty cases and have a lot of experience, mostly in losing. And if you could get a first-rate lawyer, my first choice would be Nancy Gertner, but I could give you a list of 10 or 15 who are the best lawyers in the Massachusetts area and among the best lawyers in the United States. And I picked them in a heartbeat over some Alabama lawyer who has struggled to try to prevent people from being executed. You might want somebody like that conferring on the case, but you want a team of lawyers who are the best you can possibly get.
Stand by, Alan Dershowitz and Nancy Gertner. I want to get some of our listeners into this conversation. We are talking to Nancy Gertner, former U.S. District Court judge, and Alan Dershowitz, a lawyer professor at Harvard Law School. And we're asking for your questions about this extraordinary case that is about to move. What are your questions about the case against Jahar Tsarnaev? Let's go to Steve, who's calling from Cambridge. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi, Anthony. There's been a lot of discussion about whether or not to read the suspect his Miranda rights. My question is, since so many people know that they have a right to remain silent, how can the government think that simply by not reading him his rights, they're going to somehow get more information than if they did?
Mm-hmm. Who wants to take that first? Nancy, do you want to take a shot at that?
You'd be surprised that although people may know of it in general, that failing to give, when you in fact give someone their rights, they might say, and you say it as if you mean it, they may well pause and not speak. And in this situation, they had authority not to read him his rights, arguably under the public safety exception to Miranda. But that really covered questions about are there bombs anywhere else. It really doesn't cover debriefing about his brother's trip to Russia, for example. But I take your point, although I think you'd be surprised how unsophisticated many defendants are.
Interesting. Alan Dershowitz.
There's another element to it also. You may know about your right, but when you're being questioned by four or five FBI and CIA agents, you don't really believe you have it. On the other hand, if they then tell you you have it, or if a magistrate judge tells you you have it, it really hits home to a greater extent. And I don't think the public safety exception really was applicable in this case. Once they apprehended these two people, they got all the bombs, and the sheriffs and police officials announced that there was really no public safety problem. Public safety exception was not designed to gather intelligence in the future. It was designed to prevent imminent possible attacks. But I think it's no harm, no foul, because I suspect they don't need any of the statements that he might have made un-Mirandized to make their case.
By the way, speaking of Miranda, the Miranda rights, it was very interesting reading the judge magistrate's statements and proceedings yesterday. And by the way, there's a transcript of that at RadioBoston.org. And Alan Dershowitz, just to sort of back up what you're saying, the judge magistrate bends over backwards. I mean, when he tells the defendant his rights, I mean, he says it again and again and again and again, right?
She,
excuse me. Yes. forgive me. I was reading a written transcript, so it wasn't clear to me. But yes, when she was reading the rights, she was making it very, very clear and spelling out those rights very, very specifically. 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Let's go to Sam, who's calling from Concord. Sam, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. It was very chilling to me when in the media the two potential people who they thought committed this crime were described as terrorists. Could you explain why or how a person is termed a terrorist? I mean, it seemed like the killings at all those schools like Columbine, no one ever thought to call them terrorists. So is it because they have a foreign last name? And then is there a legal definition? If there is one, please share it. So,
Sam, it's a great question. And as a matter of fact, Alan Dershowitz wrote about just this morning, making the point that Jahar Tsarnaev was not indicted as a terrorist. Right, Alan?
That was a little surprising. I think there are two possible reasons for it. One, they don't have the evidence at this point by which they can prove the kind of specific intent required under the terrorism statute to intimidate, although I think they probably could get that information. A second, the government may want to depoliticize this case, not make it into a jihad-type case, which invites a jihad-type defense. Now, here's I'm going to make a point that Nancy and I may actually disagree with. Look, there is a precedent here. There is a previous series of cases that are a little bit like this one, and that is the Weatherman cases of the 1960s. Nancy did a brilliant job in representing somebody, not a Weatherman, but somebody who was involved in similar type activities, did it successfully. But remember, these young people, those days young people, were well-educated, they were wealthy, they had every advantage, and they were building anti-personnel bombs, I'm talking about the Weatherman, just like the ones that were used here in that house on 11th Street when it blew up. They were intended to attack young American soldiers in Fort Dix, and also to attack Columbia University students. And in the end, a couple of the weathermen did kill some policemen, much like here. And now, you know, sure, they've served their time and all of that, but Robert Redford's making a movie glorifying them. One of them's now teaching at Columbia, and on her resume it says that since 1964 she's been helping people. Since 1964, you know, the 10 years between 64 and 74, she was in the Weathermen making anti-personnel bombs. So there is, I think we treat people with foreign names and foreign-looking faces a little bit differently than we treat real homegrown Americans who seem like us. And, you know, of course, they justified it by saying they were trying to end the war in Vietnam. Jihadists justified it by saying they're trying to end the war in Afghanistan. I think we have a little bit of hypocrisy when it comes to how we treat different kinds of terrorists.
Well, Alan, you anticipated a question that I wanted to ask both of you, so let me ask Nancy to respond to what you said. And sort of my question was, has there been a precedent ever, in your experience, for this kind of trial? And, of course, Alan brought up some of the work you did as a defense attorney before,
right,
before you were a judge.
But, you know, I think that you have to step back a little bit. There's a precedent for this kind of trial. Timothy McVeigh was actually charged with the same thing as this individual is charged with now. So we have a precedent, and it was the same kind of flurry after the bomb went off about sort of whether this was foreign or domestic or whatever, but he was charged with that. I also think that there is a world that is before 9/11 and a world after 9/11. And in order to make Alan's point, I'd want to look at the way we charge other people from the time since 9/11 till now. It is also not clear to me that this charge is meaningful. In other words, this is the charge that they started with. I would be surprised. They are going to present evidence before a grand jury, and that grand jury could well come out with different charges.
We don't disagree.
Yeah, this is a quick out of the box charge that matches what it is they absolutely know. And I think it could well get more complicated depending upon where the investigation leads.
But let me ask you about that, because, and again, I want to advise our listeners that at RadioBoston.org you can read a copy of the federal indictment, and it's sort of fascinating because it's a very terse, crisp, economical account of, you know, the 5 or 6 days that we all witnessed. It seems like the actual case in the courtroom would be a very short one. Am I wrong about that?
No, I think you're right. I think it's a three-day trial. If I were putting on this case as a prosecutor right now, I put on the bomb expert to show it's a weapon of mass destruction. Mm. I then put on the video, one after the other, sequentially. I then put on the testimony of the man whose car was carjacked, saying that these folks admitted they did it. You get a conviction. Then, in the sentencing phase, you put on the execution-style murder of the MIT cop, which isn't a federal case, but you can use it in trying to seek the death penalty in the attempt to kill the policeman in Watertown. And, you know, it's a relatively short prosecution case. Prosecutors often make the mistake of over-lengthening and over-complicating cases that could be put on rather simply.
And it's also very interesting. The affidavit was made without reference to any statements that Tsarnaev made, which was also, I thought, very interesting and suggested that they actually didn't need his statements.
I want to try to sneak in one more call. Tom is calling from Framingham. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, everybody. I've read the indictment this morning, and what I'm interested in finding out about is what is the legal definition of a weapon of mass destruction under the U.S. Code 2332A that was cited in the indictment, and how is it nuanced for, like, IEDs, like this pressure cooker device versus atomic bombs, biological chemical warfare weapons?
That's a great question. I'm not sure, Alan or Nancy, who wants to take that?
Do you want to try it, Alan?
Well, yeah, I mean, I can try. We don't have a very clear definition. If you use the common sense definition, if you use Scalia's plain meaning, this doesn't seem to fit the definition of a weapon of mass destruction. We didn't go into Iraq because we believed they had pressure cookers. We went into Iraq because we either believed or didn't believe, depending on who you believe, they had real weapons of mass destruction, nuclear weapons, chemical weapons, biological weapons. That's the way the term is generally used. But this statute appears to define it as any weapon capable of killing multiple people other than a firearm. And that will be an issue that will be raised by the defense, whether the pressure cookers fit that definition. Probably they do.
I want to ask one more question, and I'll start with you, Nancy, and that is about the death penalty. As we know, there's no death penalty in Massachusetts. There is a federal death penalty statute, but I'm wondering if federal prosecutors are influenced by the state jurisdictions in which they're filing their federal cases when it comes to the death penalty.
There is no question that they are. There have been four death penalty. This would be the fourth death penalty case in Massachusetts. I actually presided over one of them involving a gang, murder in aid of racketeering in connection with the gang. It was a torturous decision to.
And she wrote a brilliant, brilliant decision on it.
Thank you.
It was really brilliant.
Where essentially it took a long time. The local prosecutors in that case went to Washington, and actually, as I understand it, argued against the death penalty. It's not clear what the alignment would be here, but there's no question that there is a concern. There's also a concern about Massachusetts juries. In a non-death penalty state, the percentages of people who are in favor of the death penalty and would be, as they say, willing to impose it, are actually smaller than in other states. So there is a lot of consideration of what's going to go into this and calculation about whether even to go for it, having nothing to do with the legitimacy of the punishment, which is one question, but having to do with the juries and the politics of it.
Well, it's sure. A fascinating conversation, and I wish we had more time, but of course, this conversation isn't going away anytime soon. We're just going to pause it for now. Nancy Gertner, former U.S. District Court judge for Massachusetts. She's now a professor at Harvard Law School. Alan Dershowitz, lawyer and professor at Harvard Law School. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And listeners, you can continue the conversation at RadioBoston.org. Stay with us. Coming up, how Boston's hospitals and first responders saved hundreds of lives in the days after the marathon bombing. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.